KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in forums next hour, Marin clinical psychologist and psychoanalyst Mary Lamia will join us in studio to discuss the topic of kids and their emotions. Her newest book is Understanding Myself, A Kid's Guide to Emotions and Strong Feelings. And we'll discuss with her not only how kids can better understand their emotions, but also how and in what ways parents can help. Forum begins after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum program. Mary Lamia is a Marin County-based clinical psychologist and psychoanalyst who is also a professor at the Wright Institute in Berkeley. For nearly a decade, she hosted a weekly call-in talk show called Kid Talk with Dr. Mary on Radio Disney, and she blogs regularly for Psychology Today. And she recently published a book called Understanding Myself, A Kid's Guide to Intense Emotions and Strong Feelings. And it's a book which takes kids into a better and clearer understanding of the often confusing inner landscape of their emotions. Mary Lamia joins us in studio for this forum hour, and welcome. Good to see you.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk about kids' emotions. And I thought maybe we could begin by talking about why it's important for kids to understand or to really be able to name and determine what their emotional landscape is all about. And I just happened, sort of a sheer serendipity, to come across a recent study that said, well, when kids have better emotional control, they have better cognitive skills. So are we talking about emotional control?
It's about being self-aware and knowing what your emotions are, why they are triggered, and what they're telling you. Our emotions tell us things. They tell us, they give us information. You know, they provide us with a lot of information about what's going on. Now, sometimes there's emotional misfires, but if you know about your emotions, you'll be able to improve your social relationships. You'll be able to focus your attention. You'll be able to calm down. Emotions are so important, and yet we ignore them.
So certainly the message is to children, they need to know their emotions. They need to not ignore them or neglect them. They need to, what, monitor them and be vigilant about them?
Just understand them. And you know what, Michael? Adults often don't understand their own emotions, let alone the emotions of their children. It's sort of funny because these days children talk about psychological conditions in everyday terms. She has ADD, ODD, I'm stressed out, all of those kinds of things. And yet
I heard a kid recently say, I have psychological issues.
Right. And they're not quite sure what it means, and they think they should make it go away, that it should be done with. Actually, anxiety as an emotion is very, very important. And yet, we take kids to doctors to medicate them for it, when in fact, it can really help them in their social skills and their academic work.
Anxiety can be a fuel. It can be an octane.
Anxiety is like the engine of attention.
You also have a whole section in your book where you talk about kids who are fear-seeking. And in fact, you have a test. You have a number of tests in this book. But kids actually sometimes, maybe fear as opposed to anxiety, they like that sense of fear.
Well, you know what? We're not chased by hungry animals anymore. So I guess in some ways we are, but not by a big
carnivore.
In the singles
bars and things, yeah.
Right. So children have learned to play with their emotions, and so have adults. And it's kind of fun to play with your emotions. I'll give you an example. I was sitting at an airport one day, and a little boy was playing with his emotions and playing with the emotions of his sister by running up to his sister and trying to startle her. And he kept doing it over and over and over again. Well, he never startled her, and she finally said, "You are so annoying." But he was just trying to play with her. I was on the trail and taking a walk behind two women coming up on them, and their little boy was ahead of them riding on his bike, and he rode ahead, and he rode around a corner, and he started screaming loudly, "Mom, Mom!" And his mother runs around the corner, and the other woman, and I'm right behind them, and the little boy says, "Look, it's a coyote." And he pointed to a rock, and she said, "You know, I have told you, remember the book, you know, don't cry wolf, because then we won't believe you." And I caught up with the little boy, and I said, "But it was pretty fun to scare them, wasn't it?" And he said, "Yeah."
The difference between crying wolf and crying coyote, you don't necessarily go there.
But it's fun to play with your emotions, and kids like stimulation. That's why they like violent movies and video games and
roller coasters.
Roller coasters. It creates anxiety and fear, and we like to evoke those emotions in ourselves. But what I say in the book to kids is, be careful that you protect your emotions, and you know when to say, "I don't want to watch that," or "I don't want to do that because I don't like the way it makes me feel."
Is Bruno Bettelheim right in the sense that, he was apparently a pretty terrible human being, but when he writes that book about kids getting scared, we're talking about little kids now, but they get scared in fairy tales and then suddenly everything is restored, and that's a good trajectory for them to have that fear, like Hansel and Gretel and the witch's house and all that, but then to come out of the forest with Hansel and Gretel and realize that everything is restored and the witch has been kind of taken care of.
Well, it might be a relief. I'm not so sure that it's always good to scare children, whether it's with a frightening fairy tale or with a violent or scary movie on television. I think we need to protect our children's emotions a little bit.
Well, that brings me to a blog you just did, back to the book in a moment, but in Psychology Today, where you said external ways of sort of maintaining behavior with kids, saying, which is a form of scaring, you know, if you're naughty or nice, it will make a difference.
Oh, that was the blog on should Santa...
Yeah, should Santa be brought in? You know, you're going to get presents if you're
Santa
good.
Should Santa be used to decide if you're naughty or nice?
Well, here we're coming up on Christmas, and your advice on that is?
Well, Santa gets used as an external conscience because often children, you know, misbehave, and parents are helpless and desperate. And so they, during the holiday season, use Santa and say Santa's not going to bring you any presents. And really, we can control our children in better ways, and it's not about being naughty or nice. You know, children have emotions, and parents need to help children understand them and help them when they start to act out.
We've learned a lot about emotional intelligence thanks to people like Dan Goleman and so
Absolutely.
Forth.
Absolutely.
And this makes us more aware, doesn't it? It makes parents more aware of the importance of nurturing emotional intelligence in their children. But what way specifically can parents help to bring children to a greater emotional intelligence?
Well, when...
Aside from reading your book.
When a child is expressing intense emotion or strong feelings, for the parent to help the child recognize that emotion, name that emotion, and think about what is that emotion trying to tell you? For example, we often see it in motivational styles. Children have different ways of completing tasks, just as adults do. Some people like to complete tasks ahead of time, the do-it-aheader type people. I don't know which one you are, Michael. And then there are people
Depends
who...
Depends what the task is.
And then there are people who are so-called procrastinators. Now, just this concept and how children use their anxiety is important for parents to understand, because if you're a do-it-aheader and you have a procrastinator as a child, you don't quite understand how this child is using his anxiety to complete tasks. People who tend to put things off need the anxiety of that deadline in order to muster up the energy to do it. Now, many children get to that deadline and they need to have a fit and they get stressed out, but really they have that anxiety and the anxiety helps them to focus and then they complete the task. Understanding your anxiety and how it can work for you is very important to children. Do it ahead of time, people have anxiety because they just can't stand having something on their plate.
But you're saying it's also very important for the parent to understand this and to be able to negotiate or navigate this.
Right, especially when your daughter at 8 o'clock at night said she has to go to the store to get construction paper. I mean, that may drive you crazy, but she may need that deadline in order to complete the task.
Well, we've got different kids with different temperaments. I mean, you say parents need to be certainly aware and cognizant of what their children's emotional needs are or how they're expressing their emotions. But there are a lot of kids who don't express their emotions. There are a lot of kids who keep them within.
Yes. And then they don't know what to do about them. A woman was telling me recently that her child was screaming into his hands. And she said, "Honey, why are you screaming into your hands?" And he said, "Well, I'm just venting my stress." Actually, if he read my book, he would know that venting only stirs up the emotional brain. It doesn't calm it down. Sometimes when a child is angry, a parent might say, "Well, go into your room and hit your pillow." That doesn't work.
Talking with Dr. Mary Lemia, her book is Understanding Myself, A Kid's Guide to Intense Emotions and Strong Feelings. You may remember that John Vasconcellos, a famed California assemblyman, in fact, was lampooned and satirized in Doonesbury because he put so much emphasis, even legislatively, on the importance of self-esteem for kids. How important really is self-esteem, and how do we define making kids more, well, elevating in terms of the way they see themselves?
Well, in my book, I have a chapter on pride for that purpose. And part of self-esteem is being proud of yourself and being able to recognize your own abilities and look at yourself in an appropriate way because, you know, having too much self-esteem is the definition of narcissism. And having too little, you feel depleted and alone. So it's important to have a balance when it comes to self-esteem. I think looking at pride is one of the self-conscious emotions. So it goes along with embarrassment, shame, guilt. A lot of kids feel shame about their pride. So they win an award and then they feel guilty because other kids didn't win, or shameful because they are proud of themselves. So it's important for kids to understand the whole array of self-conscious emotions and how they balance and what to do when you start to not feel so good about yourself.
You write a lot about shame. In fact, you write about bullies, and you say the common assumption is that bullies lack self-esteem, but you claim that bullies are more driven by shame.
Yes, often parents say to their kids, "Don't worry about a bully. Bullies don't have high self-esteem. You know, they feel bad about themselves." Not true. Actual research has shown, and I have this research in the book. I have a lot of research in the book for kids. It's watered down to kid level so that they could read actual research by psychologists about various topics. And I have one on bullies. But bullies do not have low self-esteem. Bullies feel pretty confident about themselves. They have high self-esteem. The problem with bullies is that they are shame prone, and shame is an interesting emotion. Most people who feel shame hide their shame. They want to get away from it because shame makes you feel so bad about yourself that you have to hide it. One way to hide it is to give it away. And bullies give their shame away to other kids. They also give away their anxiety to other kids. So if you encounter a bully and he puts you down, you'll probably feel shamed and you'll also feel anxious. So you won't be able to say anything back. Except when you go home, you think of all kinds of things you could have said to that bully, but you become mute because they raise your anxiety so high. Important for kids to understand what happens to them when they encounter a bully, and they'll be better prepared. But the best way to prepare is to look confident, to have some pride about yourself, to stand tall, look people in the eye, smile at them, don't be afraid.
A lot of kids get picked on with all the cyberbully stuff now, and they keep silent about it. They don't, because of the shame, they don't talk to their parents, or they're fearful that somehow it will expose that rather raw nerve of shame. And a lot of kids get phobic also about things, in some instances, it's understandable for them. They
what
get phobic about
it. Dangerous emotion shame is. You know, it can inform us. And it can help us look at ourselves, but it's such a dangerous emotion because when kids feel shame, they do feel so raw and so exposed. That is the number one thing parents need to help their kids with, because there's so many things that can shame you and embarrass you, when, especially when you're a preteen or an adolescent. And if parents can help their kids with that, help them talk about what they feel and understand what they feel, that can make a big difference, because shame is dangerous.
The old notion is it's good to have your kids talk about emotions, you know, be forthcoming and be really as candid and as truthful with parents as they can be. But sometimes it's a real impediment. It's a real obstacle to get past because of inhibitions, because of anxiety about being judged, even by the parents and so forth. So I'm wondering, for example, about some specific examples that you deal with in your book, like when a kid gets upset and emotional about seeing a parent with another partner, that sort of thing.
I talk about that in the disgust chapter because that evokes moral disgust in a child.
Yeah, and so how do you talk about something like that? How does a child often doesn't want to say to a parent, I'm morally disgusted with you, right?
No, but a parent could say to a child, you know, that feels kind of funky, doesn't it, when I am with this new person I'm dating, because it just...
Yeah, and I hate you when you do that.
And it just doesn't seem right, does it? And to let the child say, I hate you when you do that. Yes, I don't like that. It makes me sick to my stomach. And you know what? It should, because it's not because, you know, somebody is taking the other parent's place. It's not because, you know, anything sexual. It is just morally disgusting. It doesn't feel right. That's a biological, evolutionary response on the child's part. It's completely natural.
And understandable and should be out in the open and discussed?
Well, I don't think a parent should impose it on a child necessarily, though they can say, I know it just doesn't feel right when I am with this other person. And that's because it's not your mother, it's not your father, and it just doesn't feel right.
So frame it, in other words, for the child as a point of discussion or as a point of at least coming to some kind of understanding.
Yes, to help the child see that what she feels is not wrong.
You also write about mourning and bereavement and children's feelings when they lose a pet or when they lose a grandparent or a loved one, which is such difficult terrain often for parents as well as for the children. Let's talk about that.
Well, it's often difficult when a child loses a pet, when anyone loses a pet, because it doesn't seem as though you should be getting sympathy from people. So often children keep that to themselves. They don't go to school and say, I lost my dog or cat or rat. You know, they don't talk about that. It's different when you lose a parent or a grandparent. Everybody knows. Everybody doesn't know if you lose your dog.
So there's more sympathy that's generated usually with obviously a parent or a grandparent. And that's difficult because kids feel very deeply the loss of pets. I mean, so do adults, but kids.
Certainly. Yeah. And grief is an interesting emotion. You know, there many people still believe that we have these stages of grief that we go through, the Kubler-Ross kind of stages, and that we go through it and then it's over with. Well, you know, I've had so many kids say to me, you know, I lost my grandfather 2 months ago and I'm not over it yet, or my grandmother died and I'm still thinking about her and it bothers me. Why do people think that you just get over a loss? You don't get over a loss.
I'm with you.
Loss is never, lifetime.
Never understood that. In fact, forgive me, but I blame the psychologists or some of the psychologists who keep saying closure. You want to feel closure.
And there is no closure. You get through sort of the initial period of grieving and mourning, but grief comes up over and over and over again in the form of anniversary reactions, for example. The loved person you lost, her birthday or death day or at Christmas time. One of my Psychology Today blogs is about grief and children and grief and during the holidays, how grief comes back up because you miss someone you loved and it hurts to not have them there. And then people feel as though something's wrong with them because they're not supposed to be mourning all over. Well, that's exactly what people do. You're not supposed to get over a loss because that's impossible.
Talking with Dr. Mary Lamia, her book is Understanding Myself, A Kid's Guide to Intense Emotions and Strong Feelings. And it is a kid's guide, although certainly it's a book that also can be very informative and useful for parents. Let's talk about something else you write about in your book, when kids get infatuated, when they get crushes.
Oh, crushes are so fun. And I hope parents handle them well, because often what parents do is they get all involved in the crush and they pick up their child from school and say, is that the boy you like? And they giggle about it. That's fun, but how about...
It can also make them very self-conscious and embarrassed.
Yes, it brings up other emotions, doesn't it? However, When you think about an infatuation, one of the ways we can help children is to talk with them about what they like about that person. Now, often a child will just say, I like him because he's cute, or I like him because he's smart. Well, you know, what else and what else? You know, what do you admire about other people? And then from there, go to what will people admire about you? What do you want people to admire about you? And what can you do to admire yourself more?
You can also start building maybe for the future and say, well, what are you looking for? And what are you going to look for when you're an adult in terms of a
somebody? I don't think they can go there, Michael.
Childless father to the man. Wordsworth said that, and I believe it. We were talking about something yesterday that I wanted to bring up with you, and that is how kids today will spend so much time with their iPhones, with their cell phones, with, you know, games and applications and so forth. I mean, so much so that it seems to divert them from just the normal kind of kid activity that at one time we all took for granted.
That is a normal kid activity these days, isn't it?
But it's something not normal about it. I mean, it takes away from my idea of normal or normality, and that's, I think, precisely the point.
One of the things kids do is they use it as a distraction when they're around people who are boring to them or who repulse them or they don't want to deal with at the time. That's different. However, what I love about all of the gadgets is that they connect people.
Well, does it make them more disassociated, though? I mean, you know, they're looking on the social networks all the time as opposed to meeting with their friends or spending time with them.
But they can also text their friends and connect with their friends. And
the virtual connection is not a real connection, though. That's I think, what's troubling to many people.
What is real? If somebody
sitting and talking to each other now face to face, Kevin in the control room, Danny in the control room, as opposed to doing it all virtually, all doing it with texting and so forth.
Well, what's left out of the texting and email and all of that kind of thing are the emotions that show on a person's face. And that's unfortunate because facial expressions, as Paul Ekman has shown us, are very, very important. However, I think in whatever way a child can connect with others, it does protect them.
We're talking again with Mary Lamia, who is a psychologist and psychoanalyst and is also a professor at the Wright Institute in Berkeley. And we'll get you involved in this. In fact, let me give out the phone number now, because you are welcome to join us in this discussion about children and their emotions, especially intense emotions and strong feelings. Her book is Understanding Myself, and your calls are welcome. It's toll-free. You can join us whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. And the number is 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your calls, so you can feel free now to join the conversation at 866-733-6786 or send us an email. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website simply by going to kqed.org and clicking on this segment. That's kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And when we return, we'll hear from you, our listeners. Maybe we want some advice from Mary Lamia, or simply want to join the conversation. Also, maybe talk a little bit about what makes for a happy child when we're talking about emotions. We talk all the time about, we're talking a lot about shame and anxiety and crushes, but I mean, what makes for happiness? Stay tuned. More when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with local author and clinical psychologist, psychoanalyst Mary Lamia, discussing her new book, Understanding Myself, which offers tools and advice to preteens who need help navigating their intense emotional worlds. And they are more intense when they're in their teen years. I mean, that's almost just part of endocrinology or hormones or whatever you want to call it. We're going to go to your calls and emails here in just a moment, but I was talking about what makes for a happy kid?
Smiling. Being positive, happy parents. You know, if you smile at your child, it helps them. You know, people have mirror neurons. When you smile at a baby, the baby smiles back. It sees your smile. Its mirror neurons reflect that. baby smiles. Smile at your children. Be happy yourself. Be positive yourself. It's very, very important.
Sometimes it's very hard for people, especially if they're out of work or they're feeling miserable or pensive or whatever.
Whether you smile or you have a frown is not going to get you a job.
Well, as the great Hans Christian Andersen said, turn that frown upside down and you will wear a smile.
Smiling is very important. You know that if you feel disgusted, if your child is eating something and says, this looks really yucky and gross and I'm just disgusted, I'm not going to eat it, it's awful. And children often have that response to different textures and food that's unfamiliar. That's why they're really picky eaters at times. If you smile, it gets rid of a disgust response.
Well, my mother used to make a dish. It's a Russian dish called pacha, which is a gelatin mold. It was actually made out of cow's hooves. There is no way my mother could be smiling with the most radiant, luminous smile. There is no way that she would get me to look at that. I couldn't eat it.
Well, you might not eat it, but you would feel less disgusted.
No, there was no way to look at it without getting disgusted and feeling yucky.
There's no way to hear about it without getting disgusted.
I won't even go into pacha. I have a whole retinue of pacha stories, which I won't even go into. Once I spilled a whole bunch of pacha, that was a whole story in itself. Quickly, though, what about, because we want to get the callers here, the idea that that parents should be pals to their kids. I mean, this is almost a kind of, especially in certain parts of like where you are in Marin County, a kind of given notion that parents should be a friend to a child, which I find troubling.
Well, unfortunately, sometimes a parent's narcissism...
Excuse me, why do I find that troubling? Because often a friend means a contemporary.
Well, but if our narcissism is so involved when we're raising our children, then we want to be popular with our children.
Exactly.
And so we can't say no because they won't like us. And it's very painful when your child is saying they don't like you or that you're mean or you're the only parent in the whole school who won't let them do something. Parents are very important as guardians of our self-esteem, but also of teaching us limits.
Boundaries.
And if you want to be popular with your child, your child may not be very popular with you when he or she grows up.
Let's go to our callers, and we'll begin with Brian. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. My question kind of is on the same vein. I've had a few friends recently that have had children, and they, in preparation, read all these books, these parenting books, counseling books. And what they found is that there's a concentration on letting the child make their own decisions without the parent's help. And I think it's really confusing for me and troubling, honestly, that it's focused on child-centered development instead of, really connecting with the parents and nurturing the child and showing the child that you can make a decision, but then, the parent's there to show you if that was a right decision or not,
It gets right to the point again, a parental role in terms of, authority, decision-making, boundaries, all of those kinds of things.
Well, Brian's question is very good because it also points to the fact that, how do kids learn? Being a role model as a parent is very important. So if a decision has to be made, to walk the child through that decision by making the decision yourself, and that's how a child learns. And the other thing Brian brings up that's so important is how desperate we are to find the proper ways to raise our children. Whatever happened to instinct and whatever happened to intuition, we are all looking for this intellectual knowledge that will tell us what to do, even opposed to our own instincts. And Brian's instincts are coming out in terms of how he's responding to this. I hope he has kids.
Yeah, good luck, Brian. All too often, parents don't know what to do, so they'll say, a child shall lead you or something along those lines. Let the child decide what he or she wants as opposed to providing direction or guidance. A lot of that is just indecisiveness and confusion on the part of adults.
Emotions give us information, and a parent should pay attention to her own emotions for that information.
On we go to Jane in San Jose. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. I've listened to you for, 15, 20 years or more, and I've never called. But I wanted to ask your guest for another book. I'm going to get her book that she mentioned, but I'd like another book on grief for children, you know, young, 12 to 20, say. I have three children, and they lost my ex-husband, their father. They lost their grandfather, and they lost my nephew all within 4 months of each other, a year and a half.
I'm sorry.
It's been traumatic. They have not recovered. I don't think they ever will. I agree with the comment about, you know, closure or just that comment. It's very true. And I also found something helpful, which seems kind of strange, but because I used to work with dying people, I just went with my gut instinct. I actually found that writing a letter, a card around anniversaries or birthdays from the relatives that died, even though they know that it's for me, seemed to give them some comfort. And I would say things from the relatives or from their father that I knew they needed to hear.
I think that's a very good idea, don't you?
How touching, Jane. It's very thoughtful. In the book, Understanding Myself, I have a whole series of things that kids can do when they lose someone they love. And it's all geared toward helping them remember rather than forget. And that's what you're doing with these letters, is you're trying to help them remember. So many times people think, I need to forget, I need to push it aside. Well, if you want to try to get through your grief and help yourself with your grief, you need to remember. And that's why the emotion of grief gets triggered during an anniversary of the person's birthday or their death or whatever it is. Our mind is trying to help us remember.
Well, grief can be such an overwhelming emotion that sometimes, I mean, people in your profession, that is psychologists, psychiatrists, will even sometimes prescribe things to help the person get through the night. It's as if, you know, they can't stop remembering or they can't stop grieving, thinking about the loved one.
I just wanted to mention, if Jane does get the book, the chapter on grief, it's short, it's sweet, and it will help your children. Now, in terms of what you just said, Michael, yes, people are prescribed things to help them through their grief. And in those acute moments, you know, maybe they need something in order to sleep or eat or function. But we always have to be careful that we don't over-medicate emotions. And that's my main thrust here is don't medicate it. See what it's trying to tell you first.
Well, you were talking, thank you, Jane, for the call. You were talking before about the truth of emotions, and there seems to be a divide in many people's minds between what their emotions tell them and what their minds tell them, that is heart and head or rationality and maybe emotions which seem more irrational, that kind of, I mean, I realize it's not as bifurcated as, unfortunately, popular culture and media seems to make it, but there certainly is a divide.
Well, that's why it's so important to learn about emotions when you're a kid, because your heart, your feelings, your emotions may be telling you one thing, but you also have to understand where there might be an emotional misfire.
Or where your emotions can be misleading you, or they can be directing you toward impulses that are unhealthy or all kinds of things, right?
Right. But in terms of kids and what they do with their emotions and what parents do with their emotions, for example, kids talk about OCD. Well, do they really know that obsessive compulsive behaviors are related to anxiety? That when people feel very anxious, they tend to do repetitive tasks or obsess or do things compulsively? It would help to know that that's all about anxiety. And what is your anxiety telling you? Your anxiety is telling you to take action, do something. But is it really telling you to do that?
Over and over and over again. Let me go to you, Karen, and thanks for waiting. Join us. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I dropped it on the bridge. My question is regarding... Oh, are you there?
Yeah, I'm okay. Here, but I didn't know that you were here, so go ahead.
Sorry, I'm here. Hi, thanks for taking the call. So the age range of children is, you know, pretty broad. Are you including children that are like high school graduating age? Are we talking about children that are, you know, adolescent and up? That's a question I have. And then the second question would be regarding the use of marijuana. And how you were talking about moral disgust, and you gave the example of a parent having another partner. What the deal with acceptance or the mortification or just how to get like a 16-year-old through this?
Well, you're talking about a younger age group here for the most part.
My book, Karen, is for 8 to 13-year-olds.
But let's take Karen's question because you work with adolescents all the time.
Absolutely. And emotions are important to deal with at any age. You know, when I was printing some galleys at Office Depot, the college students who were printing them spent more time reading the book and telling me they wished they had it when they were a kid and that they learned something. So it was wonderful.
They weren't smoking marijuana.
Marijuana. But in terms of marijuana, when you think about it, you know, what is a kid doing when he is chronically using a substance? So many kids say it relaxes them. So are they medicating their anxiety in some way? Well, I mean, marijuana is a whole program in and of itself. I'm a little bit concerned about the strength of the marijuana these days and what it's doing to kids and what I'm seeing.
And what it's sprayed with.
et cetera. But I am concerned that so many kids think they need to do something, use a substance to medicate their anxiety. And how many kids, I'm not saying this is always true, but how many kids at 5 or 6 at night see their parents taking a drink to medicate their anxiety? How many kids see that's what you do with stress and anxiety is you medicate it. You have to use a substance in order to relax. We're the role model for our kids, and it's very, very important that we look at ourselves.
Also, when you talk about substances, I mean, yeah, I think you're right about parents, whether they're drinking coffee, whiskey, whatever.
Or taking Ativan.
Or taking pills. Yeah, exactly. But there's also, it seems to me, often the peer pressure that plays into the emotions here. That is, other kids are using substances, so why shouldn't I? And in fact, it's not only often in that conformity context, it's I've got to do it because everybody else is doing it.
Well, when kids say this, especially adolescents, it's very important for a parent to put their foot down and say, just because everybody else is doing it doesn't mean you have to do it. And be a role model for that. If your kid says, everybody else is going to this party and I want to go and parents won't be there, that doesn't mean you have to say yes. If you want your children to be able to deflect peer pressure, then you have to do so yourself. You have to be the role model for that. And you have to be able to say no when everybody else's parent is letting them do something.
It's hard. We'll go to Emily next. Hi, Emily.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
I'm actually a student of Dr. Mary Lemia's at the Wright Institute.
Hi, Emily.
Hi, and I was lucky enough to receive a copy of her book and recently read it, and I just wanted to call in and say how much I wish I had had something like this when I was a preteen, that I had ADHD as a kid, and a common symptom of that is being very oblivious to your actions and why people are reacting negatively to you, and you kind of are having all these emotions, but you don't understand them, and it would have been really nice to have kind of a guide to what was going on with that and how best to deal with it.
Well, thank you for the call, Mary Lemieux.
And I expect that Emily is going to help a lot of children in her career as a psychologist.
Thank you, Emily.
Thank you.
And on we go to Peter in Berkeley. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to, first of all, say that in listening to the opening 10 minutes of the show, I probably learned 5 different things about myself. You know?
Oh, Peter, that's so sweet.
you have a very succinct way of stating these things, and I'm really happy to have this book as a reference in the future. What I wanted to ask about was I'm kind of a chronic procrastinator, and I know that this is something that, you know, began when I was a kid. And one of the things about that is that sometimes you move from the task that you're supposed to do to a task that you want to do. And performing this task that you want to do gives you a sense of accomplishment, and you feel like you're doing something where you have these tasks that you're supposed to do that don't give you that sense of accomplishment and fulfillment. And so I was wondering, how do you kind of redirect a kid to say, you know, these things that you're supposed to do, they have benefit for you as well and can be fulfilling, rather than moving, you know, rather than, you know, playing video games or something like that?
Great, great question, Peter. You know, I suspect, now let me just say again, that there's nothing wrong with being a procrastinator. There are some very, just as many highly effective people who are procrastinators as those who are do-it-aheaders. The key is to be highly effective at what you do. And if you need the deadline in order to get something done, then that's not a bad thing. As long as you get it done, you're effective and it reflects your best work and you do well. So that being said, if you're a so-called procrastinator and you find yourself getting up and doing other tasks when you should be focused on what you're doing, it's possible that you know you still have time. And so you're raising your level of anxiety by giving yourself less time to complete the task that has to be completed, and you're fooling around with other things. So if you start to feel anxious, you know the anxiety is informing you to focus your attention. You're getting near the deadline, so get with it.
And we thank you for the call. And
I love procrastinators, and I love studying them. I'm a do-it-aheader, but you know what? My son, who's a quantitative psychologist getting his degree right now, and I are actually in the process of doing a study of highly effective procrastinators.
Well, I once wrote something, I hate procrastinators, I should hate myself, tomorrow I will. Do-it-aheaders, isn't there a better term than that?
Well, Michael, I'll leave it to you to come up with one,
please. Let me think about it. Here, but before I even do that, I want to go to some of our listener emails. This is an interesting one from Ryan, who says, I'm just wondering how any of this child psychological behavioral advice is any different than what is helpful for adults. Every piece of advice that has been brought up seems like adults need the exact same thing. Smile at each other, understand your emotions, try not to vent, etc. Please help me to see how these concepts are different for adults.
I love you, Ryan, because that's exactly the case. And that's why one of the reviewers of my book, on the back of the book are some sweet little blurbs. One of them is by Michael Krasny. Thank you, Michael. But another reviewer said, if you're a parent, you should buy one of these for yourself because I learned some things I didn't know. The advice is for everyone. What I said in the beginning is so true. It's not only children who need to learn about their emotions and how their emotions give them information. It's adults as well.
I think it's also a useful book for parents as
yes.
much as it is for, I mean, it's geared toward kids, but for parents as well.
Parents seem to be loving it.
Let me read a couple more emails. Here's listener Crystal who says, in regards to kids using various forms of screen time, I'd like to add that I think it teaches the kids how to express themselves. They write words, create symbols that represent the face, emotions they're feeling. They share links to songs they like. When I was young, I rarely could find words to express myself. These kids can name it, type it with words and pictures in an instant. So not only can they name it, they express it and are very much relating. And that's from the parent of a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old.
Crystal, I tend to agree with you. I don't get all wound up about internet stuff, except when it crosses the line into availability of pornography and cyberbullying and those kinds of things. Everything has a good use, and it has a bad use as well.
I remember, no, you're right. I mean, those things are far more serious. But I remember one of my nephews looking at playing a computer game, and you couldn't divert his attention from the game. You couldn't engage him. You couldn't connect with him. I mean, and this went on for a long, long period of time. He just looked at it, and he wasn't, you know, he was looking at it constantly. It was like an addiction, really. That's a danger, a real serious danger, I think, because the kids can become so
involved.
Your
nephew was probably very successful in life? Is?
Is what?
Successful in life?
He's too young. At this point, we don't know yet.
Oh, okay.
But we'll see. Sally writes, I'm curious about what your guest thinks about the recent book Nurture Shock. Do you know it?
I'm not familiar enough to be able to comment.
Well, Sally says, I'm reading it now, and a lot of the research described makes a lot of sense. As a scientist, I'm delighted. I see it as more of an argument for actually testing out dearly held beliefs that turn out not to be true.
Yes.
On we go. Manuel, join us.
Hi. I came from an immigrant family, and that led to a lot of stress. My younger brother at the time committed suicide at the age of 13. And my question is, I'm about to have children, and how can I change myself or my environment to avoid the harrowing pain that I saw in my parents? It really was difficult, and I think I learned, and my whole family learned to, after that event, to blunt our emotions. So Yeah.
Manuel, you know, one of the things you said is very touching to me, because one of the ways in which anniversary reactions come up, if we have a sibling who died or committed suicide, when we have children ourselves, that triggers the emotion, the loss, the grief in us. And you are not your parents, and we're always afraid we're going to be just like our parents, and we often have mannerisms like our parents, but we're not our parents. Just the fact that you would call in and ask the question says you have a sophistication about your emotions and access to them. You know, shame is a very dangerous emotion, and I believe most people who commit suicide are suffering from shame, and that's why I want and hope parents will deal with that in their children.
Can shame be, and thank you, Manuel, and I'm certainly sorry to hear about your brother and your loss. Can shame also be like anxiety, a motivator? I would think so. I mean, a motivator in a good sense? I'm not talking about, you know,
yes, many people,
extreme shame.
Many people
like
do
that.
The right thing in order to avoid shame.
Yeah.
Yes.
In fact,
and guilt.
There's a whole notion that the reason that smoking has decreased is because of the social shame that's attached
sure.
to, like, secondhand smoke and smoking and so forth.
You know, emotions help us get along socially, and the emotions of guilt and shame are social emotions. I mean, they're there for a good reason. They help us interact socially. They help us do the right thing.
Catherine is our next caller. Welcome, Catherine.
Oh, hi, Michael. Thank you so much for your show. Mary Lemia, this is Catherine Alba, a blast from the past.
Hi, Catherine.
And I want to say congratulations on your wonderful book. I wanted to just comment quickly on the virtual connection. I have a 12-year-old daughter. I have a 24-hour shift as a firefighter. And her.
This is pretty frightening, because I knew Catherine when she was 12 years old.
And you are an amazing woman, you and your husband, and just you had a—I grew up in your household, and it was a wonderful household. I just want to let the listeners know that. But I also wanted to say that the virtual connection, my daughter and I text often, and it's a way for me to communicate with her on her level, and it gives me a little bit of ease coming into the teenage years that perhaps she and I will be able to continue to communicate at this level. So I understand the impersonalness of not being able to see emotions face to face, but it's working.
I agree, you know what I mean? That sometimes it's easier to communicate with a young adolescent or an adolescent in general if you text them, because it keeps them from being defensive, and sometimes it keeps us from being so defensive or offensive when we text and when we have to look at what we write. And it is a form of communication that I think is good. And Catherine, I hope you go to my website, find my email address, and send me an email. I'll send you a book. And my website, for those listening, is marylamia.com, LAMIA.
And thank you, Catherine. Along those lines, Stephen says, love this discussion. Does Mary's book talk about how to help your child choose good friends? I'd also like to hear more about the role that friends, school, and faith have in raising our kids. Please let the author know she should make her book available on Kindle, etc.
Oh, how nice. Well, Stephen, there are many, many places in the book where I talk about friendship and how your emotions can inform you when it comes to friendship. For example, if a friend always hurts your feelings or puts you down, you know, what does that do to your emotions? And if you listen to your emotions, you might not have them as a friend. So interspersed in the book, there's a lot about friendship.
Anything about faith?
Anything about faith? I don't think specifically about faith.
Well, here's a critical email from a listener named Kim, who says, lighten up on parents. One more person who thinks she knows everything about kids and how to be a good parent. One thing that I think makes parents so stressed out these days is all the pressure to be good parents and do everything right. The harder we try to do everything right, the more we feel like failures in the face of these expectations, and the more our own emotional and mental suffers, which, of course, makes it really hard to just be happy all the time. Parenting is really, really hard, and I feel like I screw it up several times a day. Also, I have two kids who are very different, so don't tell me that one thing works for every kid. I see every day that is not true. I get even more discouraged when I hear someone like your guest who makes these broad generalizations about all kids and is just so certain about everything, and that's from Kim, who's a mom of two in Berkeley.
Oh, Kim, I'm sorry if I made you feel shamed or guilty, and I didn't mean to do that. And I think you're absolutely right. We can't make these broad sweeping generalizations about all kids. These are simply tools for people to use if they see fit, you know, my book included. And it's important to have information out there for parents, but I think you're absolutely right. A parent has to rely on their own intuition and their emotions, and every kid is different. That's why it's useful to have two kids, so you don't pat yourself on the back too much and you don't blame yourself too much.
Well, here's someone who seems to find a kind of universality. Michael posts on our website, I found the emotions I express to my two young children will often affect their demeanor, positively or negatively, more than anything I say verbally. A sense of well-being in children, I feel, is intuitive, and parents are the most important gauge in their lives.
Yes, and children watch our faces, and Paul Ekman is so right that our emotions show on our face, and it's important to smile. It's important to know that your child can read you.
It's the second time we've mentioned my friend Paul Ekman this morning, who really is and has done some very substantial research. In fact, the FBI, the CIA, they all get advice from him on facial expressions, particularly
yes.
when it comes to telling the truth or not telling the truth. Mary Lamia, so good to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
The book, Understanding Myself, A Kid's Guide to Intense Emotions and Strong Feelings by Mary Lamia, PhD. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Remind you, you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling 415-553-3300. Our thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, to our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.